The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close just in view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zayas.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
All right, Higher Side Chatters, we know the world is largely run by unseen hands in a vast web of international corporations, banking oligarchs, secret societies, think tanks, bloodlines, religions, disinformation agents, and alphabet agencies, and it's not an easy task to deconstruct it. As soon as we examine the power and influence of one far-reaching network, we're exposed to another with dominion over a different sector of societal control, and the pattern repeats until our dying day. Yes, there are many hands in the cookie jar, and today we're going to look at some threads on this spider's web that haven't been brought to light as much as others, and I think you'll be surprised more than once. Our guest today is a great documentary maker and all-around master of multimedia who I've been wanting to get on THC for quite some time. His name is Josh Reeves, and he's put together some really great films that avoid rehashing the same conspiracy 101 bullet points and cover some well-sourced information I really don't hear anywhere else. From his first with 9/11 New World Rising to my personal favorite, The Lost Secrets of Ancient America, and his examination of the Rock Wall in Rockwall, Texas, Josh never fails to impress, and now his latest film, The Spellcasters, Hollywood, Scientology, the CIA, and the Truth Movement, dives into some of the previously mentioned unseen power, adds new pieces to the ever-expanding power pyramid puzzle, and exposes some leading truthers as connected agents that might be hard for some people to hear. But suck it up and put on the big boy pants, because it's happening, people. Josh, my man, welcome to the Higher Side.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. It's a great honor for me to be here.
Yeah, man. Long time coming. Thanks for doing it. You've got several films that would make great topics for a show, and maybe we can start with a little bit about your path through some of this research, because elements of older films definitely helped you make some of the most important connections in The Spellcasters, right?
Well, absolutely. It's one of those things I talk about a lot where, and I'm sure you found this in your own work and your own research, but sometimes the truth finds us in the oddest of places. You know, we're looking at certain topics and not really thinking about others. And then inadvertently, those other topics seem to rear their head in places, again, where you're not really looking for it. So same thing as you mentioned with my Lost Secrets of Ancient America work, you know, and the Rockwall stuff. I wouldn't have thought, because I did those Secret Rite Volume 1 and 2 films previously to doing the Lost Secrets of Ancient America Volume 1, and I kind of figured when I was going to that topic, I was like, oh, you know, I was kind of relieved for a minute to just kind of step away and do something different. And I never dreamed that those elements that I exposed in the Secret Rite Volume 1 with groups like the Council for National Policy would have reared its ugly head again in that work. And sure enough, it did, because one of the people that's been very complicit in covering up this Rockwall thing that you mentioned was a guy who was the longest sitting congressman in U.S. history, and he wound up being a member of this group and has done a lot of work towards covering up. He's a Freemason as well there in Rockwall. So again, you just never know where these things are going to take you. And with my new film, The Spellcasters, I had originally intended for it to only be a real kind of honest investigation into who truly controls Hollywood. I never dreamed that it would have taken me through the routes that it did, especially in terms of the connections to Scientology, the CIA, and then, of course, as you mentioned, with various other truther people and whatnot that seem to be involved in this. And I'd come across little tidbits of this stuff while working on The Secret Rite Volume 1 in 2009 and then Volume 2 in 2011, but I never quite knew how it fit. And so that's really where this film brings us. It's more than just about, you know, an expose on Hollywood. It really gets into all the elements of mind control and how all these, really what boils down to information warfare against the people are being executed against us. So it's really a wide-ranging film that may seem like it's about one topic, but the more you watch it, you seem to find out that it's connected to all these other various things. And of course, I'm working on Volume 2 right now. We'll expand more on that and get a lot more into the music industry side of it as well.
Right on. Yeah, it's definitely an evolution. This kind of research is always a process. New threads come out and connect to places we didn't expect. And So just to give people a little context, if they're not familiar with your work, you did the Secret Right series, which looks at networks of power on kind of the right side of the American two-party system. And then you did the Lost Secrets of Ancient America. And just so people understand, this rock wall in Rockwall, Texas, it emits a type of frequency, right? They're trying to tell us that it's natural, but you've looked at it and there are qualities to it that clearly aren't, right? I mean, it's a pretty impressive thing as far as ancient American secrets, and I rarely hear anyone mention this thing.
Well, it's, yeah, but it's more than just like my work and my opinion or anything that it's, you know, not a natural formation. I mean, let's just get that clear. I don't want people thinking that I'm just creating some conspiracy to say that this thing is not natural, when all the experts, there's plenty of people that came before me who have done expert analysis and analysis on the materials and whatnot. And that's really what it boils down to. And, you know, there's been a few attempted whitewashes of this information. But the thing about it that they never bring to the table is they never actually show what the materials are made up of. And it's made up of a lot of very different, very rare crystals and minerals that have been sourced from various locations and then brought together to create these composite stones. You've got stuff like zircon, garnet. Zircon and garnet are the two most prominent minerals found in these stones. And these minerals that are found in these stones do not naturally occur anywhere near within hundreds and hundreds of miles of where the rock wall is located. That's the number one thing. There is no naturally occurring. Any geologist that knows the area and takes a look at the area will tell you that there actually is no naturally occurring rock in this area whatsoever. So anything found there would be an anomaly. And that's one of the things that the people like the Smithsonian and the scientific community, when they've tried to downplay it as a natural formation, they sort of whisper the caveat. They say, well, yes, it's a natural formation. We never found another one like it anywhere else on Earth. Next. I mean, they try to move away from that. And that's really the key. They've never found another one like it, yet they know for a fact that it's a natural formation. But being made up of zircon, garnet, tourmaline, it's even got some very rare earth metals in it. The kicker for me was niobium content. Now, if people look up niobium, niobium is a material that we didn't even know existed until the late 1800s or so. It can only be extracted from another element called columbite. So in order to get that material, you've got to be able to have columbite you extract it from first. Now, we use niobium in the modern day to create jet engines, rocket engines. We use it to reinforce pipelines. It's because you can essentially pass a lot of electrical current through it without getting an overabundance of heat. It also contains tourmaline. Tourmaline is the only mineral that you can apply a high level frequency to, and the crystal will never shatter. This is another element of this. Plus, it has, between the stones itself, it has what has been called through the analysis a geopolymer mortar substance. It's a mortar substance that was created from three different types of quartz crystals that were brought together, mixed together, and then put between these stones. And when they hit the air, they actually expand and solidify once it hits the air. And you mentioned the frequency response of this. When there were archaeological digs conducted on the late 1990s, they discovered that when they had their digging machines on top of where the wall was, the low frequency oscillations from the engine of these machines caused the entire wall to shake and vibrate and start to produce an electrical current. And there are metal rings that have been found embedded in the wall that look almost like our power outlets, modern power outlets in the house that you would plug something into. And these rings, which I've held in my hand, are smelted from copper, aluminum, and tin. And now, there's never been any commercially found tin deposits anywhere in the world outside of Russia, I mean, much less in Texas. So again, the metallic elements and the mineral elements that make up this wall, not to mention their, of course, their alignments with the solstices and the equinoxes, is really, really one of the main things we have. But what's interesting is the fact that this thing, whatever it was, doubled as a seawall, because when you start to dig down on certain areas of it, there was shark's teeth found embedded into the wall. There were sand dollars that should have been, you know, by what they tell us, thousands, maybe, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of years old, that when you crack them open, had fresh meat inside of them.
Hmm.
And the main kicker of it is that the soil analysis, you can actually see where, if you look at some satellite images, you can see where this blue shale a lot of the wall to get to where it is, you have to dig down really, really deep, and you have to pull all this blue shale because according to the soil analysis of the area, the soil is really, really tricky and very different right around the area where the rock wall is than it is anywhere else. And when people are trying to put down foundations on houses, they have to go all the way down to the bedrock in order to be able to put stilt foundations down because of the soil. And the reason that is because somewhere around 12,700 years ago, right in line with when we know there were, you know, a worldwide great flood event, the soil analysis shows beyond any shadow of a doubt that this rock wall was covered in a catastrophic event that happened somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico, somewhere in the neighborhood of 13,000 years ago. And when you start to look at other evidence and whatnot, and that's what led me to this. I didn't really know there was anything else around the United States. I knew about the rock wall when I was starting to really try to make the case that it wasn't a natural formation. I said, well, if there's any truth to this, then there has to be other examples of this and other things around, you know, the United States that would match up with this. So I was very shocked to start finding stuff because I started hearing that there were mounds and some of these different mound sites found around rock wall too, which I had never heard. And then once you start finding out that all these ancient sites around America and indeed around the world all share these same equinox and solstice alignments, that's when I started figuring out that, you know, this was not a coincidence. And then the stories from the late 1800s, early 1900s from the Rockwall newspaper where multiple giant skeletons were found around the area. And then I started to find, wait a minute. And I didn't even notice. I had really no idea that there had been other ancient sites and other mound sites found all across America, specifically in the Ohio Valley where I've traveled, where it's just crazy if you ever get a chance to go there. And there again, large amounts of giant skeletons found, sites with the equinox and solstice alignments. And that's really what led me to all that work in the Lost Secrets of Ancient America Volume 1 and going back and actually showing people, look, you know, this is the possibility of who these people could have been, especially when you combine the fact of these various artifacts that are being found and the dates always going back. I mean, that's one of the things that the main reason why they've tried to downplay the rock wall and keep it from coming out is because once you start getting into the timeline of how old this thing is, it turns everything we've been told about there being intelligent people on this planet way up, because you start looking at, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 432,000 years old is what we're looking at as far as this rock wall.
Wow. Yeah, man, it definitely moves the needle back quite a bit. And, you know, as you laid out, they obviously, somebody spent great effort into crafting this thing. I mean, what do you think the purpose of that was? Was it more than a seawall? Was it part of a larger structure at some point? Have you got any kind of speculation on what that exotic combination of elements is capable of doing?
Yeah, well, it's 20 miles in diameter, this entire wall. So, and it encompasses, in the modern day, pretty much the entire city of Rockwall. Now, I always get these emails, and before people start emailing me, you can't go out and see any of the actual wall. People always go, I want to know where I can go see the wall. It's buried. You can't. There are places where you can see pieces of it that have been dug up, but as far as what it was used for, that's the thing. People have to start looking at things and understanding that it's very difficult, especially when people start looking at something that is perceived to be that old, because they start looking at it from their own modern perspective. You know, we think of, like, we build a building, we, you know, do we just build it for one purpose? But this thing had a variety of usages from, and really all what it was used for, I don't think we really know. I mean, for instance, one of the things that's been found are these tunnels, these underground tunnels that go down to the closest water source nearby. And with some of the construction and stuff, there's been a lot of speculation that at one point, maybe it was used to actually hide from these giants. There's been stories of some of these giants being cannibalistic. One of the stories that came from Rockwall about the giants was this underground cavern that was found that had this giant pot in it with human bones that had been cooked. So, it, you know, appears with these underground tunnels that possibly there could have been people there hiding from giants and utilizing these underground tunnels to go to get down to water. But that seems to be something that was probably done much later. That's the fascinating thing about the evidence, is that the top layer of the wall is like a primitive form of concrete. And as you dig down farther and farther, the stones get bigger as you go down. And no one's gone down the full 100 feet down to the bedrock yet. But as you continue to dig down, the stones get bigger and bigger. And you start to see that this top layer, this top concrete layer, was added. It was added to these things at some point. We don't know when, later on. So this thing probably took on a variety of usages throughout the years. As we mentioned, the evidence for it producing energy is that possibly this thing could have been designed to produce enough energy to launch something. It's very interesting that the exact location of where this rock wall is at the exact same trajectory for the perfect entry and exit way into space. Now, space shuttles and stuff like that, they actually have to have a specific trajectory. And back in 1999, they were going to land the space shuttle, I guess, in Cape Canaveral or whatever, and there was bad weather, and they couldn't do it. So they had to bring in the space shuttle in the second best place they could for that trajectory. And lo and behold, that was right over Rockwall. And I actually saw it when it came in. I mean, it looked like what you think a plane or something crashing would look like, but just these huge multicolored streaks in the sky as it was coming back in. It didn't know until years later when I started looking into the Rockwall that that's exactly why it had done that. And there's been, I've had all kinds of strange events. Even before I knew about the Rockwall, right in the area where it is, I've had multiple UFO sightings there as a youngster. Missing time events. There seems to be some sort of magnetic anomaly on the bridge of Interstate 30 near where part of this rock wall is buried. And myself and a friend and several other people I've talked to have had missing time events where you cross the bridge, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. When you get across to the other end, you look at your watch and you're going, why is it 5 o'clock?
Wow.
That literally happened to a friend of mine when we were in high school. We didn't even know anything about this rock wall yet. And we'd left to go to work, and it was like 1 o'clock when we left, and we stopped to get gas once we crossed the bridge, which is only like a 5 or 10 minute trip. And we stopped to get gas, and we're like, how are we late? And we're like, it's 5 o'clock. And we're like, how's it 5 o'clock? I mean, it was really bizarre. And another friend of ours, once we told him this story, he didn't ever want to admit it. And he was like, I haven't ever told anybody this. But he's like, now that you guys are mentioning that, I had the exact same thing happen to me. I didn't tell anybody because I didn't want people to think I was crazy. So that combined again with the materials, that's, I can't stress enough how rare so many of these materials that are found in the rock wall are, like tourmaline specifically. Tourmaline, first off, to be able to get it, you have to extract it from quartz. It appears naturally on quartz, but in the rock wall stones, it's not formed on any natural quartz. It's just ground up into this matrix. And there was a oil geologist from a major oil company who took a look at these materials. And he said, in his opinion, based on his scientific training and knowledge, that because of the materials, this is just what's so fascinating about it. I mean, it's not just the materials. It's the engineering elements and aspects that went into this that predate us knowing any of this stuff, like the buttressing. It has a buttressing effect into it, built into it, to where, it won't fall over, and all these very specific engineering feats, especially the ability to take all the materials that it's made of and then mix them all together. If you and I were to take all these same materials that are in the rock wall and mix them together, their molecular structures would just all mix and bond together instantly. For some reason, from some process unknown to us today, the individual molecular structures of these different minerals remain independent in situ within the rock wall stones. They do not bond. This specific oil geologist told me that is not possible. His exact words were, that is not possible in Earth's current gravity. So the gravity on Earth itself would have been completely different in order for the environment to even be able to do what is done in this wall. It really is fascinating. I don't think I've ever seen something have as much focus on it to be covered up as this. And it's fascinating that the people who first deemed the thing to be unnatural were Freemasons. The guys started trying to dig water wells. These people around the area, nobody had named the town yet. Everybody wanted to name it after themselves, and Jonesville and Johnsonville. And everybody starts trying to dig these water wells. And when they start trying to dig these water wells, they keep hitting rock. And even back then, they knew that there was no naturally occurring rock there, so they couldn't figure out what it was. So one of the farmers eventually started digging this thing up. And when they started digging up, they started noticing, wait a minute, this is way too perfect. So they brought in the Freemasons who had established the town, and they came in and took a look at it. And they were like, well, what do you think? And immediately upon looking at it, it took them 2 seconds of glancing at this thing to see masonry work. I mean, they saw the stone work of their own people there. So that's when they told these settlers, look, you know, none of you guys are going to get to name this after yourself, because this right here proves there were people here before any of us. So that's what they gave the town name Rockwall after that, to be neutral, because that was really the only thing they could name it.
Man, you know, obviously this is a little off from what we planned to talk about, but it's all fascinating. And one other question that has been coming to mind recently, whenever I'm talking to a guest who talks about celestial alignments of some of these structures that date back sometimes tens of thousands of years, yeah, isn't it strange that they're still aligned? Because with plate tectonics and the Earth's wobble and the fact that we're spinning at, you know, thousands of miles, and these stars in the sky are, you know, millions of light years away, isn't something weird about the fact that they're still aligned in so many cases?
Well, that's, again, I think that goes back to the engineering aspects that were put into this. I mean, when I started going out to a lot of the sites, and that's what we do in the Lost Secrets of Ancient America Volume 1, I traveled all over the country to go to these ancient sites. And again, you know, these things are still measured to this day. You can literally go out and watch these measurements and see them happen even today. I mean, one of the strangest things to me that I discovered was at Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, because what blew me away about that, and it's right exactly in line with your question here, is wouldn't these things change over time? Well, what even blew me away about that place was that a lot of these have, as you mentioned, a lot of these sites have solar alignments, and there are other sites that have lunar alignments. And the interesting thing about Chaco Canyon is that it has both, which is rare. I mean, you just never see that. You never see a site that actually has solar and lunar alignments. And what's fascinating about that is that these lunar alignments, some of the ones that are marked in Chaco Canyon, would have taken someone living in the area for 50 to 60 years prior to there ever being, and you know, people back then didn't live that long. There had to have been someone, because living there for 50 or 60 years minimum prior to these alignments being encoded into the structures, because they mark and document things that only happen every once in a, you know, pardon the phrase, but every once in a blue moon. Very rarely do these alignments actually happen. So how was someone able to accurately know and predict these lunar alignments and then build them into this structure without living out there for, you know, at least 60 to 100 years? That's the thing about it to me that's fascinating, is that there was a high degree of knowledge and technology that was put into these things. And, you know, today it's still very relevant. And another thing I found in these ancient sites, and I've even found them locally here in other sites, are the mathematics, especially like with a lot of these sites in Ohio. There's one here not far from Rockwall. There's a town here in around Dallas called Flower Mound. And I never thought for years it would have anything to do with his work. And then I started looking into it and finding out, wait a minute, you know, there was this giant mound here. It's 666 feet above sea level. That got my attention, because I started finding 666 in all of these ancient sites built across the Ohio Valley. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with the mark of the beast or anything like people think, but it goes back to the Babylonian numerical system that they numbered their gods in, and 666 was the number that they attributed to the sun god. So with the solar alignments in these sites and the connection back to the Babylonian numerical system, and that's another thing, Native Americans did not have knowledge of the base 60 numerical system. It just wasn't anything that they had. So again, that's when I knew that, okay, we were dealing with people who, the evidence shows, came from the ancient Middle East. They had very sophisticated knowledge that in some cases goes beyond what we even have today. And the evidence of their being here is scattered all across America. So, yeah, that's really what the basis of both of those films, The Lost Secrets, is really all about.
Yeah, man, I love them. And that is a thread and topic that I love when I see researchers digging in deep, because, you know, growing up here in America, I would always hear about the Giza Plateau and be like, oh my God, you know, I can't wait to be able to afford to be able to go over there and see these things. Meanwhile, you know, things are all around us here in North America, and they're just off the radar. And it's because they were built out of earth and things that may look more natural rather than the things that the Giza Plateau is built out of. But it doesn't mean that in the back of mall parking lots or underneath their construction, there isn't some amazing things like right here in your own backyard to find.
Yeah, there's stuff. I mean, there's stuff scattered all across the entire United States, and there's been so much that's been covered up and stuff that's had lakes built on it. I mean, we'll just never really, we'll never really know how much is here. But I think it's important to, as you said, you know, keep digging and taking those opportunities when we can.
Amen, man. And it is a sad shame and injustice, you know, the fact that so much of it has been lost. But to switch gears and do a kind of a 180 over to the Spellcasters, I did love this film. Of course, it is going to be one, and there's going to be more to follow because it is so deep as well. But you start that film with the question, who runs Hollywood? And you note that so many people in this alternative realm will just chalk it up to the Jews. But that really is a gross oversimplification. What can you tell us about the erection of Hollywood and some of the players involved in its infancy that you get into in this latest film?
Well, yeah, it's a great thing. That's one of the things I want to encourage people, especially people out there who are researching this kind of stuff on their own and doing their own homework, and it is that sometimes, in some cases, yes, I'll give you that, in some cases, the most obvious answer is the true answer, but not in every case. And that's one of the things that I discovered with this, is that if you look at who founded Hollywood, unquestionably, it was the founders of Hollywood were Jewish, and their whole idea of getting away from that, because they found out when the motion pictures technology first started to develop, they figured out that, and this is no joke, I mean, this is honest truth, you can look it up, they started setting up what they called Nickelodeons, and back then, risque pornography was not a naked woman. It was a woman showing her bare ankles. I mean, that was considered risque filmmaking, but they started noticing that people would pay money up front. That's when they knew they were onto something. They're like, wait a minute, we've got people who are lining up. They're paying money up front before receiving any product, before they get anything. So we actually get their money. And then when they come in, what they're shown could be total crap. And I think it's kind of ironic, because that's kind of what downloading and streaming and stuff has kind of killed within the movie industry and the music industry. It's killed this whole thing where you get their money up front, and then once they get into the theater, if what they're shown is crap, well, then so what? Ha ha, we got your money. It's killed that whole thing. But that was the business model that they started up with, and really it was about being able to get away from having to pay royalty fees to the Edison Trust for the use of their cameras and their camera technology. So they said, well, you know what? We've got money. We've got other people. What we're going to do, we're going to go out here out west. We're going to start our own studios, and we're going to be so far away from the East Coast, where the main movie industry at that point was headed and located, that we'll be able to basically do whatever we want out here. So it was set up with that spirit and the idea of basically going against the mainstream. It really started out as a very underground thing and was very independent, until it started producing money. And once it started producing money, and then you had, you know, World War II happen, and you started having a shift in balance of power across the board, the powers that be started to understand what a powerful manipulation tool coming electronic media at that time, radio, you had stuff like even the H.G. Wells War of the Worlds broadcast, which I could have put in there in the film, and I really kind of forgot to. That was kind of an early, you know, test really the response of the public and kind of gauge. And really, I think the more I look at it, I think it was really one of the earliest forms of psychological warfare. You know, I really think that's what it was. And so once that power was seen by the powers that be, they started trying to get their hands on it. And that's what we discuss in the film. We show all the connections to what happened with the Hollywood blacklist in 1947 and how that coincides with all these other insane events, world-changing events that affect us to this very day, where power consolidation and the government's ability to be able to do whatever they want in secret without having to tell the American public, all that stuff came together in 1947. And it also came and coincides exactly with the formation of Scientology, MKUltra, and the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you just touched on something I definitely wanted to ask you about, because a real light bulb went off in my head. But when talking about something as big as Hollywood, I think skeptics to the idea that it's a highly controlled manipulation machine would say that it's just too big. There's too many people involved now and all that stuff. But they forget that many of the founding studios are still the biggest, and there have been culling events that removed a lot of the filmmakers who weren't part of the larger agenda which is the real subtext to what you mentioned, the Red Scare blacklisting saga, right?
Absolutely. And that's really where you get into the whole idea of why the perception that Jews have run and still run Hollywood with no other involvement. That's why that's come about, because a lot of these guys, once the Hollywood started being taken over in 47, they kept their mouth shut. They were essentially given the ability to be able to be in power and be in charge over this while taking their marching orders and being told what to do by the federal government and whoever else at any time. And this is really why after 1947, you started to see the motion pictures and everything coming out starting to be more manipulative, and things there where they were, you know, these Jewish filmmakers were making films that were predominantly revolving around gung-ho, go America, patriotic ideas. And by their own admission, they were only doing this because they turned a profit. They didn't care about those ideas and want to put those out there. But because these things were able to turn a profit, this is why they got behind them. And then this is mirrored in the modern day with script approval. And now the Pentagon, the DOD, giving certain films script approval and allowing their weaponry and technology and whatever it may be to be depicted in the films in exchange for final say for what goes into the content of the films. That way, if there's anything that they perceive as being too close to the truth or something that may expose a lot of the black ops and things that are going on, then they get the final say to say, no, we're not going to do that. And that's control. I mean, anytime you have any government agency that it has final say and dictates the content of a motion picture or a TV show or anything else, that by the direct definition of it is government control of that. So I was just fascinated to see that 1947 was the establishment of the entire national security apparatus. It was set up and really modeled after a lot of the Nazis that were brought over after Project Paperclip. You had all of these various people that were trying to lock down the power structure within the United States to give them total secrecy and to be able to operate with impunity. And so it's just fascinating to look at these players who were on the ground floor of the OSS during the MK Ultra, people like Sumner Redstone, you know, who was in the OSS at the same time that L. Ron Hubbard was. And you start to see how later on these people became the biggest things in their particular field, but all started in 1947 during the time when the mind control and trying to not only control individuals and create willing slaves, but also to manipulate and to create a false narrative and reality for the entire world that everyone believes is real. And that's, I mean, people talk about the Matrix and things like that, but long before there was this idea of a digital control realm, these people were setting up a control room where they create reality through television, through movies, and then they do it in such a way where they get people to start to believe that reality reflects a real reality. And I think that we've all been at some point probably taken by this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, man. It is a deep manipulation that has been engineered for a long time. And so let's bring Scientology into the mix here. You know, most people, they know it's popular in Hollywood, but I've typically just chalked it up to some new age cult for bored actors. But as is usually the case, it's a lot more than that. Can you tell us a bit about the origins of Scientology and why we should really keep an eye on it?
Well, as I mentioned, it started out with L. Ron Hubbard, who was in the Navy. And then right around the time that he supposedly left, he shifted into operations from the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which predated the CIA. And around that time, right after Project Paperclip, the government became interested in creating its own mind control program that it had seen the Nazis have success with. So they started mining. There was a former Nazi scientist, Dr. Strughold, who had conducted all these experiments in Germany, and they brought over after World War II. And then he started basically giving them all his information, and they started trying to figure out how to create truth serums. They wanted drugs that basically could get a foreign enemy to give them any information. And so after transitioning from the OSS, L. Ron Hubbard was sent over to England because they had noticed that during a lot of these mind control elements and aspects that the Nazis had been working on, one of the things they were combining with this and had had great success at combining with was the use of black magic and incantations and things where they could put put people in a certain state, and then their mind control drugs or the ability to create these what they called robot assassins, they had a much stronger effect with the use of black magic. So L. Ron Hubbard at that time was sent over by the OSS to go to England to infiltrate the Crowley organizations, Aleister Crowley organizations, such as the OTO, to gain this various magical knowledge that they could bring back and then use in what would eventually become the MKUltra mind control program. And so while he was there, he did indeed befriend Aleister Crowley, and Aleister Crowley gave him the magical initiate name Freighter H. And for many years, people never knew who Freighter H was until it was later revealed that it was L. Ron Hubbard. But that was when he was instructed by Crowley in the magical arts, and he was also told about this gentleman in Hollywood, California, who had just set up the first branch of the OTO in America there by the name of Jack Parsons, who was trying to do this ritual, this Babylon working ritual, in order to conjure the Scarlet Woman, do all this. Well, this immediately got L. Ron Hubbard interested, so that was when he went back and met with Jack Parsons, who went on to form, of course, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He went on to create these elements that they still use to this day in solid rocket fuel boosters that are pentagram shaped. And the pentagram shaping of them actually allows the fuel to burn at a more efficient rate. And they're still used in ICBM missiles and everything else to this day. And this was where L. Ron Hubbard started to see that when you learned these magical arts, you could combine them and use the phraseology. And that's really what it boiled down to, was the phraseology, the speaking, the cadence. This was really the early days of what would become NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, which was also developed there with the MKUltra program. So once this information was attained, L. Ron Hubbard in 1947 started to write, based on what he had discovered from Aleister Crowley and his experiences with Jack Parsons, started to write what would eventually become Dianetics. And it's interesting that the way that his writings were set up for Dianetics are modeled almost word for word in some cases to Aleister Crowley's own work. And then some of the things in the very early MKUltra documents, there is stuff where L. Ron Hubbard took things that you can see in these MKUltra manuals that are in some cases are taken word for word, where he didn't even change the wording of it. They are exactly the same. So once they started to figure out that the information as far as black magic and being able to create and control people, and really it boils down to what his son described as soul cracking.
Yeah.
That's really what it's all about, is being able to use these techniques that open a person up and make them susceptible to control by these entities, which seem to be demonic in nature, that Scientology then calls Thetans, and then tells its flock that these are these dead alien souls, and, oh, you know, give us all your money and we'll help exorcise them from you. But when in reality, what they're doing is they're allowing their subconscious and conscious mind to be opened up. At each successive level you go up through the OT levels, you are opened up more and more to control. And L. Ron Hubbard's own quote was, "Scientology, a very effective mind control system that would turn people into willing slaves, could be deducted from Scientology." And that was the entire point of it. And his technology that he later used and invented also would go on to create the CIA remote viewing technology in the early 1970s. So all of this stuff, and it's just mind-blowing. We were only scratching the surface here. I really want to encourage people to see the film, because, you know, it's almost 3 hours, and I'm certainly not going to give all the information away here in the interview, but there's just more to it than I can tell you, and I hope that people will definitely go and check it out.
Absolutely. I mean, just seeing some of the footage itself that you have is worth the price of admission, because you can talk about it all day, but you got to see some of this stuff. And you really just laid out the crux of it. So many people think of L. Ron Hubbard as just some crazy sci-fi writer who came up with this idea for a money extracting religion. But when you get into these military connections, he's sent to infiltrate the OTO. It seems like what you're saying is Scientology is this amalgamation, this branch of MKUltra that is structured like a magical secret society. And just like what you said, I mean, with the OTO, I've talked to people who have studied it in depth, and some people who are even members of it, and they always talk about the goal is to strengthen the connection to the spirit world, to communicate with entities. But it seems like, you know, Scientology is some type of Trojan horse to get people involved and, of course, take all their money. But at the same time, yeah, like you mentioned, with each level, you're kind of manipulating people's minds and bodies to be more open to taking in entities. And that is provocative, man. It's very provocative.
Well, it's also fascinating, too, that a lot of the original signatories on Scientology from its founding, you know, even though L. Ron Hubbard had rules against people from the FBI, CIA, any sort of government outfit agencies going through Scientology training and or auditing sessions. And yet many of the signatories and the people who originally signed the incorporation papers for Scientology, many of them were current FBI, current OSS. I mean, you had all sorts of people that were in these agencies from the very beginning, and some of them became, I think there was one guy that became the first, he was the very first number one OT level 7, which is one of the highest that there is. He was an NSA agent. And even though the rules stated that, you know, no one could do this, of course, they did it in secret. And that goes back to a lot of these safe houses and these places where they were doing some of these. Well, they had various sites where they would tell the practitioners of Scientology that L. Ron Hubbard was going to write the next levels or whatever it may be. Oh, he's going here and he'll transmit the next level to the other higher ups in Scientology from these locations. But essentially, these locations were nothing more than fronts, and they were using all of the data and the knowledge that they had gotten from people in these auditing sessions. They were then selling this information off to the highest bidder, including the KGB and Russia. In the heart of the Cold War, L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology were using these safe houses to sell information and knowledge that they gleaned from the auditing to the highest bidder. So when you start to look at those connections and connect back to some of the people in the modern day that have connections back to the KGB as well, then you start to see this bigger picture that this is essentially just an espionage group that is basically using weaponized humans through the ability to be able to control them in their every thought. And then, of course, as you mentioned, the perfect front for all this, of course, the perfect front to have the people perceive what this thing actually is for it to be just some kooky cult started by a sci-fi writer. That's the front. That is why it's so perfect, because when people don't go any farther than that, just as we mentioned earlier, when people just think, oh, well, it's just the Jews that control Hollywood, and they don't go any farther than that, then you're able to keep that perception of knowledge in a controlled way, because people are only thinking, well, it's just this and nothing else, so there's no reason to look into it. That's where they get you, and I think that's why they've gotten away with this for as long as they have.
Yeah, man. And you mentioned Thetans, and for people who don't know Scientology all that well, Thetans are what they call alien ghosts, or it's a big part of their religion.
Not ghosts, but actual souls.
Alien souls. And yeah. Which is really, this is basically a code for demons, right? I mean, that's your contention, because they're not going to tell people, hey, let's open you up to demons. So they made up a word to kind of put a different packaging on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing when you look at, as you mentioned the OTO there earlier. That was one of the things for me for years from studying Freemasonry and looking at the different levels of Freemasonry, specifically in Scottish Rite Masonry, and how each successive level in Freemasonry, it's the same way. Each successive level that you go up through Masonry, the rituals and whatnot that are in the ritual books, if you actually go through and read them, and I have, that's what they are. They're these kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? They're kind of like dressed up versions of these same sort of stories and these things where they do the same thing. They each successive level of Freemasonry opens up your soul to control. And eventually, once you get to the highest level, supposedly you're fully controlled by one of these entities. And the same thing with Scientology as well. Once you reach the highest OT levels, you may just look and appear to be, you know, just a normal, regular person. But this is where the completely autonomous takeover by whatever these entities are, these Thetans, again, come into play. And this is not contested. I mean, L. Ron Hubbard's own son, we've got interviews and audio with him in the film where, you know, his very own son says, yeah, absolutely. Scientology is absolutely based in black magic. And this soul cracking is absolutely all about being able to open people up to control. And my summation, what worries me the most is, you know, I can see the argument people could make. Well, if they, you know, if they want to do that to each other, then, you know, whatever, it's none of my business. And I would agree. But as you'll see when you watch my film, what it appears and what worries me is that they want to unleash this on everybody. And they want to do it in ways and make things where the ultimate goal is to have this soul cracking ability be able to be unleashed on people without them knowing it. At this point, in order for them to be able to do this, you've got to go through these levels. You've got to go through the auditing, through the training. The ultimate goal is to be able to have, maybe through technology, I'm not really sure at this point, but some sort of ability where they can do this and unleash it electronically, whether it be through films, the internet, or everything else, and get this soul cracking to happen on a level where they don't even have to have people go through the various OT levels. And that's very scary.
Yeah, it definitely is. And in the film, you talk about Scientology and its beliefs on aliens. And, you know, we just kind of talked about that a little bit, that it's kind of coded language. But this might get into kind of the disinfo elements or their larger agenda, their larger manipulations of culture. But how does Scientology's beliefs on aliens relate to the way aliens are portrayed in Hollywood and in the general culture? Is there a connection there? Are they trying to manipulate us to think a certain way?
Well, that was something I wasn't aware of until I got into this film. Some years ago, somebody had said to me, "Hey, have you ever watched Battlefield Earth?" I'm like, "No, I'm not watching Battlefield Earth. I'm going to watch that crap. It's, you know, terrible." I'd heard it was terrible in Scientology. I'm not going to watch it. And someone said, no, really, you got to watch this. And I'm like, why? Why would I want to watch it? No, just watch it. Okay, so I watch it. And I was blown away. I was like, wait a minute. This is taken verbatim, absolutely, from stuff like Zachariah Sitchin and some of the ancient Sumerian texts and stuff. It was basically the Anunnaki 101.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a race of aliens who are coming to Earth to mine for gold, and the Intergalactic Mining Company, and basically enslave humans. And when I started putting together the connections to the CIA with L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology, and I started noticing and researching more, you don't find, see, that's the thing is, what people don't understand is there are many, many people who become Scientologists and are Scientologists for decades, for years and years and years. And unless they have the money to pay for the upper level OT auditing sessions, they don't get this information. The Xenu stuff and the space alien stuff and the rest of it does not get introduced into the picture until you reach the very upper echelon levels. You know, we with the internet and whatnot in our modern day, we have a much larger grasp of this information than people did 15, 20 years ago. But, you know, when people talk about, oh, Scientology's into aliens, that's the thing. They don't get into that till the very upper echelon levels. And when you start getting up into those levels, that's when they start to talk about you being able to become, once your thetans are at full operating procedure, I suppose, you're basically have the ability to be able to manipulate what they call MEST, M-E-S-T, matter, energy, space, and time. And any high-level OT is given the information that essentially reads like the Sumerian story. You know, we were seeded by these extraterrestrials. We have this power, blah, 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 this, that, and the other. But that doesn't, again, that only really a small percentage of Scientologists ever get to the information about the extraterrestrials and the aliens. So when you look at how through the years the aliens have been depicted as hostile and coming to Earth to wipe us all out and kill us, and then Scientology says, well, no, these other extraterrestrials came a long time ago and trapped these other ones here, and they died, and now their souls are in us, and that's what causes our misery and this and the rest of it. And it kind of doesn't make sense, because on the one end, they tell you, well, it's these dead alien souls that cause all our misery. And then they later tell you, well, but by activating them and making them active in you, that's how we make you better. Wait a second here. Something about that just doesn't sound right. But it really was fascinating for me to see how the disinformation and how the scaremongering towards extraterrestrials, specifically when you look at the fact that in 1947 was really when what kicked off UFO hysteria in this country and really kicked off the whole mass UFO sightings, and how that directly correlates with the same year with Roswell, with MK Ultra, with L. Ron Hubbard first starting to write the Scientology stuff. All that stuff happening in the same year was not a coincidence. And this really has become, what I believe, the way for them to give us one narrative that we've all taken. Because for years, you know this, for years they told us that UFOs aren't real, aliens aren't real. If you believe it all, you're a kook and you're a nut. And now, over the past decade, that shifted around. And now they're going out of their way through TV and movie and the rest of it to try and convince us that extraterrestrials are real.
Yeah.
So that's one of the fascinating things, is that you could see that for whatever reason, why did that shift? Why did they spend the many, many years trying to convince us it wasn't real? And now they're all about trying to get people through shows like Ancient Aliens and whatnot to believe these things are real. It's because they want to have a controlled rollout of this that will then help solidify the agenda for global control.
Right. And just like you mentioned Ancient Aliens right there and Stitching a little earlier, this to me was a real revelation, because it explains why a major network, History Channel, owned by the same people who are, you know, manipulating culture and don't have our best interests at heart, it explains why they would push a show like Ancient Aliens so hard, because clearly there is an agenda behind it, and it seems like you're really nailing it.
Yeah, it really is all about being able to have the people believe that the story, I mean, it really is mind-blowing, especially with the stuff of the spellcasters. I mean, I couldn't even really put it into words when I first started realizing that, okay, I get this now. The knowledge that the powers that be have about extraterrestrials has been what they've been trying to keep from us from all this time. Now, apparently, whatever Scientology knows about extraterrestrials ties into that directly. And I think we really started to see why from the very beginning, because L. Ron really, his work and all this stuff started out strictly as his work for the government in the creation of these mind control things. Now, once he had this knowledge and acquired this knowledge, that's when he started saying, well, wait a second here. And that's why MK Ultra and the levels of the Crowley OTO stuff and Scientology mesh all together. Because he was saying, well, I mean, of course, they're going to use it for this usage, but I can use it for my own usage. And that's when I started seeing that whatever these two entities know about extraterrestrials, they have a mutual beneficial interest in keeping the status quo of disinformation going as far as what it entails. And when you look at how Scientology views themselves, I mean, they make people sign billion-year contracts where, like, where literally that means that you are tied to them through successive incarnations. So right there, beyond any shadow of a doubt, you can see that they believe in, you know, like the transmigration of souls and, yeah, and reincarnation. They believe that Scientologists are doing work that is beneficial and necessary, not just for Earth, but for the entire universe. They believe themselves to be these constantly reincarnating individuals, and that anybody who is against them or tries to stop them should be dealt with, and any mechanisms or usages that can be used against them should be used against them. There's a very interesting interview with, it's a famous, you can go find it on YouTube, one of the famous interviews with Tom Cruise, and it's like an internal Scientology interview. And in this interview, he says, it's all about KSW, man, KSW, it's all about KSW. And you're like, KSW, you know, what does that mean? And he says, keep Scientology working. That's what the term means. KSW means keep Scientology working. Now, one of the things Crowley talked about is that he talked specifically about language and the use of language to have multiple meanings, and how you would say a phrase, and to the profane, it might mean one thing, but to the magical initiate, it means completely something different. That's what the KSW, keep Scientology working. He isn't just meaning keep it going and keep it active. By saying keep Scientology working, he is referring, working is a magical term that is used for magic and practice, just like we mentioned with L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons doing the Babylon working ritual. By Tom Cruise there saying, you know, we got a KSW, keep Scientology working, he is literally saying we have to keep the black magic in practice, and we have to keep it going. And that's why they are now having these campaigns to sort of, you know, expose David Miscavige, because they are literally going to bring Tom Cruise up as the titular head and hope to say, well, you know, Scientology, yeah, it was bad. We had bad people running it for a while, but it's good now. And they want to merge all these different religious beliefs along with the stuff like Zachariah Sitchin and the idea of humans being seeded by extraterrestrials. This is how they want to bring Scientology in as the one world religion. They want to merge all these things together. They want to show the general public that we've been wrong about the ancient past. We've been wrong about religion, and that Scientology is the only religion that reconciles both. And it's the reason why it makes sense. And Tom Cruise has now just recently in the past few months now moved into the former headquarters of Scientology in England. L. Ron Hubbard's former residence is now where Tom Cruise lives.
Huh. That's interesting, man. And even if you don't call yourself a Scientologist, you're still absorbing a lot of their ideas that they're putting into your head through their stranglehold on media. And let me take this to a weird place, or try to maybe connect it to the stuff we were talking about earlier with the Lost Secrets of Ancient America. But when we're looking at these mounds and stuff all around the world, really, off in these alignments to star systems in particular, a lot of them are aligned to Orion. And just as Scientology seems to be obsessed with manifesting spirits and opening doorways here on the physical plane or within physical bodies, you can almost make the case that these ancient cultures were going the other way and somehow trying to transport themselves through some type of gateway or portal up into the stars, whether consciousness or in a physical way. Do you see any parallels here? Do you see any indications that they might have been successful in doing something like that, or that there might be an underlying theme that connects these two subjects?
Well, it is interesting, and I'm not really for sure. I don't know if I've come to the point yet where I could effectively put a connection between those two subjects. But I will say this, in a lot of the ancient sites that I visited across the United States, specifically a place like Moundville in Alabama, one of the things that was fascinating to find is how a lot of these sites are built to mirror what is talked about in the ancient Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And that is this process, and also in the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, is the process of essentially the being able to incarnate in various existences and forms essentially at will. Now, this is what you find in the heart of Freemasonry as well, and also the Rosicrucians, is this idea of the ability to transcend the death of the physical body and incarnate in another physical body at will. Now, this knowledge is encoded into a lot of the ancient sites like Moundville in Alabama, and it shows that the people who built these things would have had to have knowledge that went back to the ancient Babylonians, the ancient Sumerians, as well as the alignments to the Deneb portal. And yes, supposedly these different alignments to these different sites, when you are at the sites, when these alignments happen, supposedly that's when the conditions are right for these portals to open, where entities can travel back and forth from the locations, say the Deneb portal, the Deneb star system, to Earth when these alignments happen. Now, as you mentioned, the idea of, well, specifically at Moundville, Alabama, they had something like 5,000 something people building this ancient site for, you know, however many years. And then all the people who built it disappeared off the face of the planet. No remains were ever found. Nothing. These people have, and they were quoted by the people at the time as just having disappeared. So it makes you wonder, did they go through one of these portals or whatnot? And you mentioned something of bringing stuff in and stuff going back out. I think we're almost talking about two different things. One, I think, is the ability to be able to transcend the death of the physical body and incarnate in another material body at will. But what's different about that from Scientology is that Scientology is not talking about doing this through multiple incarnations. It's strictly about the current incarnation being controlled by something outside of itself. Now, could that mean that at some point these things, two things could reconcile and they could have something to do with each other? Absolutely. But I don't know that we've gotten to the point yet where we can say that's absolutely the case. But it is a fascinating connection, Greg. I never really thought about it like that.
Well, it's just funny because in our typical mainstream culture, nobody's talking about portals or what seems like almost teleportation on an intergalactic scale. But the ancients seem to be at least have these kind of belief systems. And then covertly, we're hearing things like in our modern times where these secret groups and black magic groups are also kind of working in that same wheelhouse, even if their agendas and motivations are different. You know, it even comes up with some researchers talking about deep level science projects like CERN and the Large Hadron Collider, you know, the idea that they're trying to open up some type of portal that has more nefarious agendas behind it than just colliding some particles. And they have these ritual workings in front of their facility with the whole Shiva statue and the weird things you can see there. So there's definitely strange elements to secret government projects, to religions that are Trojan horses for demon possession. And, you know, I don't think the ancient stuff is nearly as nefarious as what we're experiencing now, but it is involving the same type of stuff. It's just kind of strange.
Well, I think what it is that people will see this in the spellcasters. That's kind of where the stuff where I was connecting the Scientology and CIA stuff to the truth movement and disinformation agents. That's kind of where that comes into play, because I think that a lot of this stuff, as you're talking about, that people have gotten onto is really indeed what they're trying to cover up.
Yeah.
And why you see certain figureheads and certain people who won't talk about those subjects at all and never bring them up, because that does get into that. And I'm working on, I hope to have it if we can get all the funding that we need to get it done by next year. That's one of the things I'm going to discuss in Lost Secrets of Ancient America, Volume 3, is because I've actually gone out and documented stargates and locations of stargates across the United States. And I'm going to be revealing, I don't want to give it away here now, but I will be revealing in that film the evidence that we found for one of these massive stargates being here in the United States and a massive structure being built on top of it to cover up. They've hinted about it in Hollywood movies as well. And there's all sorts of iconography and things that surround this. And it appears to me that, yes, there is one of these ancient portals here in the United States. And again, a lot of this stuff has been disinformation and whatnot has been put out to cover these things up, because they at some point are planning on using these things. Now, whether that's, as some people have speculated, some people think, well, they want to open up these ancient portals because they want to bring the Anunnaki back through to come and rule over Earth. You know, all those things are speculative at this point. But again, when you look at what they're trying to get us to believe versus what they are trying to downplay and the things they try to say are kooky and crazy and probably not real. And then over here, well, you're saying that's kooky and crazy, but yet you're trying to get me to believe little green men are coming to stick things up my butt while I'm asleep. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, those are the things where you start to see, wait a minute, they're trying to get me to not believe things that are plausible. And then the implausible things are the things that are being shoved down our throat through shows like Ancient Aliens and the rest of it. So I think people eventually are going to figure this stuff out. And, you know, this stuff is not going to have as much of an effect on people as it's had up until the present time.
Mm-hmm. Well, man, that pretty much does it. Fascinating stuff. And we definitely left a lot on the table for people to discover when they see the Spellcasters film and other ones. Before we go, please remind people where they can watch your films and support that independent work that you're doing so well.
Absolutely, Greg. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to come on with you today, man. We'll definitely want to do another show with you in the future. And
for sure,
please let me know, you know, if there's other films of mine that you haven't seen and or whatever, and you want me to send you some stuff over, I have no problem doing that.
Cool.
And people can go there to my website. We've got a download shop. There's lots of audiobooks in there that I've done that people can download. All my films are there. We've got DVDs and Blu-rays and stuff for sale. But also, as you mentioned, my work is 100%. I mean, we get no outside funding. We don't get Fox News checks. Neither does Greg. So, you know, all our films are all funded by you, the listener, and people out there. I mean, right now we're trying to raise $1,800 just so we can get out Spellcasters Volume 2 before the end of the year. And not very many people can make a documentary on such a low budget. And that's because I do all the elements of this, from the researching, the writing, even to the composing of the music, the editing, and everything. So, yeah, you know, just going and getting some downloads and, you know, making a donation to our work and our film so we can continue would be a big help from people out there. So thanks again, Greg. I really appreciate you having me on today.
You got it. And thank you, man. We will have to do it again. But until then, just keep doing what you do.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care. Wow, now that is a solid round of conspiracy goodness. Big thanks to Josh Reeves. He really knows his stuff. Scientology, of course, pops up here and there, but it's never really been the focus of a THC episode, largely because I find it silly. But maybe I was naive. Clearly, it seems that I was. The Plus show here does get pretty wild, and honestly, this isn't something that I really thought about when starting THC Plus, but even the $5 paywall is good sometimes if you want to talk about something to more of a closed group rather than it just being out there for anyone to grab and share around and start trouble with. If you heard the second hour, you probably know what I'm talking about here, but several alternative researchers and personalities get called out for being agents of the Scientology machine, including one guy I kind of like. And my attitude is, look, I had Josh here to talk about the spellcasters, and that is a big part of it, but each person, each listener, has to decide how big a deal links to Scientology are for them. To do that, you probably need to know more about the organization. I think Josh makes a really great case for this group going very deep. I mean, if those handwriting analysis tests are legit and L. Ron Hubbard actually wrote letters the authorities attributed to Lee Harvey Oswald, and then one of these agents of Scientology writes the book on JFK conspiracies, turning everyone's focus somewhere else, well, that is worth paying attention to. But regardless, I loved the topics of this show. We spent a good deal talking about the Rock Wall in Rockwall, Texas, which is just fascinating. And then all the content of the spellcasters. I mean, we've talked about L. Ron Hubbard and his attempts to create a homunculus moonchild with Jack Parsons. But to say that Scientology is a cult built on opening up individuals to demon possession, I mean, that goes deep, and that is interesting, right? I loved it. And the second hour is even juicier. Please sign up for THC Plus so I can afford more bars on my windows, bigger locks on my doors, and more drugs to deal with this Rockefeller Rothschild prison planet as best I can. No, I'm like 40% joking on that. But do remember, if you go to the new redesigned website at thehiresidechats.com, you can sign up for a free week of THC Plus, just like you would with Netflix or Hulu or any other subscription service that lets you do this kind of thing. And you can try it on, wear it around for a while, make sure that you can still conveniently listen to the Plus shows. And if you had any concerns about how it was all going to work logistically, you can test that out. And I hope you will. And I've done my part. Your move, spellcasting Scientology sorcerers and human husk creators, you're fucking...